and satisfy the Jacobi identity.
We have looked at the Lorentz group in several forms. Let's see, this is another class. Unless you want to separate the Laplace equation really badly. On the coordinates, we can find some matrices that multiply the coordinates and give us new coordinates for space-time. And you know what these look like. This is the stuff that tells us x is gamma x minus bt, and t is gamma b minus bx over c squared. But y is, y prime is y, b prime is b. Okay, there's an example of one of these matrices. Matrix? Nothing. This is a linear transformation. So I could write this as a matrix equation. Okay. So, yeah. Linear equation, that's a typical one. It also includes rotation. So, we know about that. We found the infinitesimal generators of the Lorentz group. So the algebra, expanding infinitesimally, we have some j-units. We divided them into some j-i's and k-i's, six generators, the k's generating boosts, the j's generating rotations. We found the commutation relation to those. We've looked at this from the point of view both of SO31, so real 4x4 matrices, and from the point of view of SL2C, 2x2 complex matrices. And we can find these same generators in either representation. In the SL2C, this is the SO31 representation. We get the matrix that gives you this. So this is x prime, y prime, z prime, p prime is some 4x4 lambda times x, y, z, t. And these lambdas depend on b and c and sines and gammas. So you could pull out what that matrix has to be. For SL2C, we found that the J's, we take the J's to be the Hermitian matrices, poly matrices, and the K's to be I times of those. We can represent them that way. We wrote them that way as a way of finding the algebra. There are other ways we might write them. This is with the understanding that we're going to exponentiate. When we find the groups from the Lie algebra, we exponentiate with an explicit I. That's why we can choose rotation generators to be Hermitian. Normally, a unitary transformation, which is a rotation in complex space, is the exponential of an anti-Hermitian matrix. Well, the anti something, you stick in that I by hand. That makes it anti-Hermitian. Anybody have any questions on anything so far? I mean, we did this, I think, first week. And a general transformation in either representation, a general Lorentz transformation can be written as the exponential. Here's our explicit I, and he uses this convention, so let me write it down. Minus I theta dot j. So, minus I theta dot j plus and then eta, I think he uses, yeah, I eta dot j. Where, okay, theta and eta are triples of real numbers. Those are the parameters. Those are the real parameters that label the group element. So this is a typical group element dependent upon six real parameters. and here you see the explicit I times sigma, that if we just had that, it would be, with the Pauli matrices, it would be SU2. If we have this with, where the J's are three, real, 3x3 anti-symmetric matrices, that would be SO3, just the real rotation group. Okay. Moving on to 2.4, tensor representation. We know how multi-index objects transform. Each index gets a copy of our Lorentz transformation matrix, the alpha beta. If we, let me see now. If we have a something with an index down, it transforms with the inverse matrix, like this. So V tilde beta would be given by multiplying by the inverse to lambda. Now the inverse to lambda is related to lambda itself because we know that eta, that lambda preserves the Minkowski metric. That's the defining property of Lorentz transformations, is that they should preserve this symmetric tensor in this sense. If I multiply by lambda bar, let's say, beta rho, then I get eta alpha beta lambda bar beta rho is equal to eta mu nu lambda mu alpha, then on this, the beta is going to give me a Kronecker nu rho. And I want to invert this, so I'm going to multiply by eta sigma alpha as well. Then on this side, I get a Kronecker sigma beta. So I have lambda bar sigma rho equals eta sigma alpha eta mu rho lambda mu alpha. If I now use the eta's to raise and lower indices on lambda, this is going to raise the alpha to a sigma. This is going to lower mu to a rho. Maggiore uses this to transform covariant tensors. So Maggiore writes V tilde beta is lambda beta alpha V alpha. He writes something like this, where he defines lambda beta alpha to be the regular lambda with the indices exchanged. This is totally equivalent to orthogonal transformations being O transpose being O inverse. It's totally analogous to that. So all we're doing, it's basically a transpose here that gives us the inverse. It's the same thing happening. So two different notations for the same thing. I like to think of the down indices transforming with the inverse transformation. That's the more general relationship. But so don't be confused when he introduces this symbol. That's all that's going on. Okay, now we talked about reducibility of representations. All right, representations are things the group acts on linearly. And we know that tensors, actually, sums of outer products of vectors are the things that SO31 acts on. If we want to know what SL2C acts on, it's going to be sums of outer products of spinners. Right? We can build up all ranks of tensor by taking outer products of pairs of vectors and summing a bunch of outer products. We can build up any matrix we like that way. All right. This is in general how you think about higher rank tensors. Suppose you take the outer product of
17 spinners. And now you take a sum of a whole bunch of things like that. Well, that's going to be a ranked 17 tensor under SL2C. Okay, it'll have 17 two-component spinner indices on it. You know, it'll be some, you know, T, A, B, C, where A and B and so on equal one or two. You know, one of two complex components. This can always be written as the sum of, you know, some coefficients times, you know, chi A, chi B, a bunch of spinners, chi, something like that. Sum over a bunch of those things. Okay? So, this is a way of building up tensors that lets you see immediately how they transform when you do a Lorentz transformation. When we do an SL2C transformation of this tensor, how do we do it? Well, it's just doing a matrix transformation of each of those vectors. So we know how a 2x2 complex matrix acts on those component vectors. So one of those 2x2 matrices acts on each free index here, just the same way as here. You know, we've got two indices, we get a lambda for each one. We can think of this as a product of two 4 vectors. Okay. This representation is reducible. Let's take the example, I've told you this a number of times now, I think, of, say, a matrix, a second rank contravariant tensor T alpha beta. Okay. It has a symmetric part, it has a trace, it has an anti-symmetric part. Those are all, under a Lorentz transformation, the anti-symmetric part of this transforms into an anti-symmetric thing here. So the symmetric part is never mixed with the anti-symmetric bit. Similarly, the trace of this, actually the trace doesn't require any lambdas at all, the trace is a Lorentz invariant quantity. So it never mixes with the anti-symmetric or the symmetric part. The trace-less symmetric part transforms independently of the anti-symmetric or the trace part. So I can decompose T alpha beta into an anti-symmetric part and a trace. Let's see if I want to do this. Let's write it as 1 over n times the metric times the thing t. So notice if I can track A alpha beta here, then here I get 0. Here I get eta alpha beta with eta alpha beta. That's the trace of the product of a metric and inverse metric. Product of an inverse metric with a metric is a chronicer. The trace of that is the dimension time of the space. So since we're in four dimensions, we'll put a 4 here. Okay, and that just cancels that and we're left with T. So T is the trace, eta alpha beta, T alpha beta. And finally, the trace less symmetric part, okay, the symmetric part, we add the thing to its transpose, but we want to subtract off, I'm betting it's going to be something like a half eta alpha beta t. I want this to be traceless. If I can track this with eta, I get a t and a t minus 4 over 2 is 2t, yeah, that's it. So this has vanishing trace. Okay, this, I claim, is a Lorentz invariant decomposition of a rank 2 tensor. Everybody with me here? How about it? I'm kind of moving along. We've covered a lot of these things in more or less detail. I'm going to spend more time today, you know, focusing on stuff I've talked less about, but I want to cover it all, so I'm just one more. But tell me if you want to.
I'm just noticing that this T cancels out. So one half eta AB.
Yeah. It does.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they have equal this.
Right.
I mean, those two cancel.
Right.
Yeah. So this is an identity. Yeah. It's just that these particular combinations are irreducible. Right? Let's count degrees of freedom. The antisymmetric part, how many degrees of freedom in an antisymmetric 4x4?
Three?
You're thinking of 3x3.
Oh, okay. Oh.
So right. 4x4 antisymmetric, how many independent components?
Six.
So how degrees of freedom of that? 6 degrees of freedom for this. There are 6 free functions in that. How about the trace?
4.
How many free functions in a free function? Okay. And how many degrees of freedom in the symmetric, let's see, I'll say it, how many degrees of freedom in that thing?
Is it all the rev?
It better be all the rev. So we started with 16. So it had better be 9. Why is it 9? Who can do the counting for me?
4 along the diagonal.
4 on the diagonal.
And then the 3 upper right have to be the negative of the...
Four dimensions. How many upper right?
Six.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So there's 6 off diagonal. Yeah. They match the 6 below diagonal. So there's 6 there. There are 4 on the diagonal. That gives us 10. Where's the other one?
The trace.
Trace. So it's trace left. That means that those 4 diagonal ones really amount to 3. Because there's a constraint among the 4 diagonal ones.
All right.
So we have 9 degrees of freedom for a traceless symmetric So there's notation for this. What we write is, okay, we think of this as a product of 2 4 vectors. So it's something like a direct product of 2 4-dimensional representations. And we can decompose the result into a 9 and a 6 and a 1. These are the invariant parts with, after we multiply all possible 4 vectors together to get all possible 4x4 matrices, what we find is that they divide up into subspaces of dimension 9, 6, and 1. Okay, this is notation. We're gonna see this notation. When we talk about particles, this happens all the time. Where you will have seen it before is in quantum class when you do angular momentum. When you multiply angular momentum states, all right, you have multiplied a half m times a half m state, and you can show that this is a 3 plus a 1, right, where the 3 are the 3 symmetric combinations, okay? It's the plus a half, it's the symmetric plus a minus plus, and it's the minus minus state. And if I take the antisymmetric combination, that's a single state plus minus 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 plus. To how many of you does that all mean something? I'm sorry to yell at you. You'll see things called Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. Right, when you take quantum, they'll talk about the addition of angular momentum. This is what they do. So, if you get a hold of a quantum book and look at the spin section in there, you'll see them doing this kind of thing a lot.
I didn't believe you could
do that. Well, let me just say,
helpful thing.
This comment is helpful to those of you who've seen it, and it's not helpful to those of you who have not. Here's what we can do with that. Okay, so let's see. Why is he talking about the Jacobi identity here? Oh, fundamental and adjoint representations, he mentioned. Let me talk about, you know, three different representations you get for most any Lie groups we're going to be considering. Okay, we've seen, how the transformations act on vector space. And then from those vectors, or general four vectors, not just coordinate four vectors, we can build higher rank tensors. The vector representation is called the fundamental, because it's the one you build all the other tensors out of. So the fundamental representation of SO31 is the set of four vectors. All right? That's the simplest object that SO31 acts on. Then other representations like the tensor or rank 3 tensors or so on are built by taking some of the products of the fundamental representation. The fundamental representation of SL2C is the single two-component spinner. Right? Again, it's the vectors that SL2C acts on, but now they're complex two vectors instead of real four vectors. And we build all other tensors by taking some of our products. So this idea of a fundamental representation is useful. It's probably just the simplest vector space that the thing acts on, the simplest vector space, because, of course, matrices form a vector space too. But it's the one, but I can build this vector space out of, you know, the set of all four vectors out of this one, so that's the fundamental. Okay. More significant mathematically, and in fact for physical purposes, is the covering group. All right, that's the one that has the most transformations in it. Mathematically, it's the one where the group manifold is simply connected, but that carries with it a lot of properties. For the Lorentz group, it's SL2C. For any pseudo-orthogonal group, that construction of spin PQ. So if we have SOP2, there's a covering group, spin PQ, that is probably some unitary group or symplectic group. It's going to be one of the standard classification groups. But the systematic construction gives you a 2-to-1 cover of any pseudo-orthogonal group by a corresponding spin group. That spin group is the covering group. You won't find a representation of the group that has more transformations than that. And that spin group will always be simply connected. So it's the covering group that leads us to introduce spinners into our description of space-time theory. And it turns out they're there. They're measurably demonstrated to be present in nature. You know, nature really has spin. So nature knows that there's this covering group. Okay, so we have the fundamental representation and the covering group. The covering representation. There's one more that's going to come up called the adjoint representation. The adjoint representation happens because of a few tricks. For an n-dimensional group, there is always a representation by n matrices. And it's given by the structure constant. Suppose I let G, my structure constant, sorry, in his notation, we've got F, A, B, C are the structure constants. Let me let generator B have matrix components F, A, B, C, like this. All right? these objects defined this way, if I'm defining G here, those will satisfy the Lie algebra. This will always be a representation of the Lie algebra, and it follows from the Jacobi identity. If you write the Jacobi identity, I've got, in general, GA with GB with GC, plus cyclic permutations of those three identically zero. That's just flat out true for matrices. But if I write what this means, this is the commutator of GA with F, B, C, D, GD, plus the cyclic permutation. And now I have the commutator of GA with GD, so what I get is F, B, C, D, F, A, D, E, G, E. And then anti-symmetrized on ABC is zero. Well, this is true of the structure constants, not this G. So it follows that F D C G F A D E plus F C A D F B D E plus F A, B, D, F, C, B, E is identically zero. And that will be true for any Lie algebra. But if you use that definition I just gave you, you'll see that you've reproduced the commutation relation. So let's take this. This is equivalent to the Jacobi identity for any Lie algebra. But now, what if I define this? Let me call these G tools. These could be any basis. Let me define the adjoint representation this way. Is everybody listening? Okay. Almost. So what I wanted to every F here I'm going to replace by a G tilde now. So this first one says that G tilde C B D times G tilde D. Now, wait a minute. I want this multiplication. I'm summing on D. I want that to be a matrix multiplication. So I'm going to interchange AD and put a minus sign. So I'm going to call this G minus GA DE. Like that. Let me see. I think I'll be okay here. Then for the second term we're okay. We have G tilde, and this will be A, the C, D component. And then we have G tilde, let's see. Now, again, I'm going to flip it again. So I get minus, so now I have D, D, E. And then finally here, I'm going to flip that second one again. Let's see, we have G tilde B, A, B. And then minus G tilde C D E equals zero. Now let me see.
Question.
Yeah.
Why do we get a minus sign in this flip?
It so far it's come from D3. I want a G A, the D E component. The structure constants are anti-symmetric.
Oh, right,
so I can interchange
those
two. As I just put
okay.
it in mind.
Okay.
I'm going to undo one of them. Let me see. I want to undo this one because I want to make this GA the B component, and that's going to make this a plus. So here I flip both of them. I flip that to make it DA. I flip that to make it DC. And then I made this identification. And if you look at that first and last term, this is just the commutator of g tilde a with g tilde c, the b e component of the commutator. If I bring this one to the other side, let me write it again as a structure constant. That's just going to be f a c d. And this one, let's see, is actually GB. I want to interchange those two. That gives me a minus sign. And then I have G tilde D, the BE component. So everything's a BE component. I should have put a minus sign in my definition here. All right, that would have gotten rid of this sign. But you see what I'm getting is G tilde A. Let me fix it. Let G double tilde A be defined as minus G tilde A. All right, so I get a minus here, minus here, minus here, and get rid of that one. So two minuses on each side is six. So what this says is that G double tilde A commutator G double tilde C is plus F A C D G double tilde C. And I've reproduced the algebra.
F A C D are the structure constants. F A C D.
The F's are the structure constants. I'm going with Maggiore's notation on the structure constants. I like these C's because they're constant.
Not constant.
Yeah, sort of together with functions now, but F's are constant. Okay, any questions on this? You see basically what I've done is I've used the Jacobi identity to establish a relationship between the structure of constants such that if I identify G tilde A as, let's see, what I really want here is, what would do this? So I want minus this, so it would be the first one. So as F A C C. So if I take my generators to be that matrix, for each A, I take the generator G A to be the matrix F A, think of B C components, then those matrices satisfy the Lie commutator relation, commutation relation. Certain particles in nature act like representations of this particular basis. So this is one that comes up. It's kind of fun to show that it works, but it works. And the Jacobi identity will hold because these are matrices in the
associative. Yeah.
Okay. That's the adjoint representation. Now, the next thing that happens in the chapter is we start decomposing tensors, Lorentz tensors, under SO3 action. All right. This is a little weird. Lorentz tensors, those are tensors under SO3-1. But if we restrict SO3-1 to just the SO3 part, we can ask what happens to any given Lorentz tensor if we just do rotation, not boost. And that's useful. It tells us about the spin properties of the thing. So this actually turns out to be a useful thing. Essentially, what we're doing is a decomposition into space plus time parts. This is really what's happening. So, simple example. Let's look at two simple cases. If I have a 4 vector, I can write that as a v0 and a vi. We do that all the time. Okay, under SO3, we know what happened. V tilde 0 isn't changed by the spatial rotation. The time component's only involved in the loop. V tilde I is a rotation matrix dj. It transforms as, well, what do we call this? Right? This is your fundamental representation of SS3. This is your fundamental representation of SS3 1. This is your fundamental representation of SS3. It transforms as a vector, you know, 3 degrees of freedom. This doesn't change. That's transforming as a scalar. So what we're saying is the alpha is really a 1 plus a 3. All right, under SO3, it depends which groups you're talking about. You've got to keep in mind, you know, what group transformations you're interested in. So the alpha under under SO3 1, the alpha is a 4. It's the vector representation, 4 degrees of freedom. You know, that all four components of this mix up when we do a general Lorentz transformation. But if we're restricting to SO3, then these two things become, then V alpha becomes a becomes reducible. So even a vector, a 4 vector, is reducible with respect to SO3. So these are the irreducible parts of a 4 vector under SO3. Let's look at the tensor. So suppose we've got our tensor up here. We know that under SO3 1, our T alpha beta gives us a scalar trace, a 6 degrees of freedom in the antisymmetric part and 9 in the traceless symmetric part. But under SO3, what happens? Well, we've got T00 goes to T00. That's the scalar. We have T0i is going to rotate as 3 vector, 3 degrees of freedom. The time component, the T with x, y, z. Think of the Maxwell field tensor. Right? You've got the electric field in the space-time component. The magnetic field is in the space-space part. Each of those is a 3 vector. So we have, in general, I guess we've got an I0. That's going to transform this way, too. I hope I'm not getting too many things here. So there's a 3. We'll see how our degrees of freedom go. Now, when it comes to Tij, what happens here? This thing's going to decompose, right? Because this is the spatial 3x3 of a 4x4 matrix. It's got a symmetric part. It's got an anti-symmetric part. And it's got a trace. So this is going to split. So the trace, T II, let me write it, is a scalar. Then the anti-symmetric part, Tij, that's going to be, that has 3 degrees of freedom. That'll be a vector. And finally, the symmetric part of the spatial bit, that's going to have the remaining 5. We've got 9 degrees of freedom here. We know that's a 5. If you think of these as, right, we're under the rotation group here, right? The number of degrees of freedom in an irreducible representation of the rotation group, we classify that under SG2, right? But it has 2J plus 1 degrees of freedom, right? So a spin half system, 2J plus 1 is 2 times a half plus 1 is 2 degrees of freedom for a spin. A 3 vector, right, is said to have spin 1. It has 2 times 1 plus 1 is 3 degrees of freedom. A 3 vector, 3 degrees of freedom, spin 1. Okay, so this is a j equals 1, this is a j equals 0, what's a 5? 2j plus 1, where j is 2. So this is a spin 2. 2, not 0, 2.
Irreducible tensor under rotation, under SO3.
So what do we get? We get two scalars and three vectors and a spin two thing. When we decompose, three vectors, two scalars. Oh, yeah, actually, that's equation 2.41. No, 41. Okay. That's what he's doing. And he talks through it in a slightly different way. So I'm hoping you sort of put it together both ways as you read through this. Okay, any questions on this? Now, of course, this isn't actually the representation we're most interested in. We really want to decompose these things under SU2. Or really, we decided to label them by SU2 cross SU2. We saw that SL2C had a Lie algebra generated by the JI and the KI. We found commutation relations of the JI and KI. Did you? And if we took two certain linear combinations, if we take J plus or minus I to be JI plus or minus I times KI, then we see that the J pluses satisfy the Lie algebra of the same as the Pauli matrices. You can normalize different ways here. Let's see, call that JK. We saw that the pluses and the minuses commute with each other. And all right, so this is the Lie algebra of SU2. Here's another Lie algebra of SU2 for the J minuses. By taking these particular complex linear combinations of the JI and the KI. Because we're taking complex linear combinations, these J plus and minus are not generators of SL2C. You know, you're not allowed to take complex combinations of the generators to get a new set of generators. But they are a perfectly good way to classify states. And we know how to classify states under SU2. Right, SU2 states irreducible vectors under the action of SU2 have dimension 2j plus 1 and z component m. Right, the set of these things for all possible all allowed j and m, where m runs from minus j up to plus j. So there are 2j plus 1 values of m. So varying m is just looking at different components of this vector. The dimension of the vector is 2j plus 1. And since j can take half integer values under SU2, the dimension of these vectors includes every integer, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way to 6. So this is a way to classify all the things that SU2 acts on. So essentially by giving the dimension of the vector. So what we're going to do is classify the tensors that FLCC acts on by the two copies of SU2, the plus and the minus. So a J plus and a J minus. So once we know that, the J plus acts on this one, the J minus acts on that one, J plus ignores this, J minus ignores that, and this classifies all the things that FL2C can act on. So the fields that we're interested in can all be labeled in this way. These are the things we're going to want. First we're going to study the classical field theory of them. So these are our spinner reps. We looked a fair amount at this. We can ask how we can study various cases here. Okay, so cases. The simplest is 0, 0. J plus is 0, J minus is 0.
That's a scalar.
Under a Lorentz transformation, nothing happens. It's the same scalar. Not much to say about it. We know scalars. Klein-Gordon equation, right? The function there is a scalar. Now, let's look at a half 0 and similarly 0, 1 half. All right, these are going to be spinners. And we've talked about them a bit. These are right and left-handed spinners. Okay. What we talked about is how when we do a parity transformation, okay, you know, J is like angular momentum r cross t. It's a pseudo vector. It doesn't change under parity. It's unchanged by parity. However, the K, a boost, you invert your x, y, z coordinates and you change the direction of the velocity, so K goes to minus K. So parity is going to turn J plus into J minus and vice versa. And that means that, you know, one of these is a left-handed and one of these is a right-handed spinner. We'll call this one the left-handed and call that one the right-handed. And there are some properties we can look at here. We'd like to know what a Lorentz transformation that acts, you know, how these things transform under Lorentz transformation. So we have actually we have some subset of Lorentz transformations that correspond to plus and minus. So let's see how we find these. What we need is, right, for this one, is it plus minus? Let me be sure that I'm doing it. Oh, sorry, minus plus. I'm going to write this minus plus. So keeping in agreement with the text. All right, so psi L, right, that's going to be acted on by J minus. J plus acting on psi L needs to be 0. So we take the J plus generators to be 0. So we need some J minuses to satisfy this. Well, the Pauli matrices will do it. So if we invert this basic relationship, so what we have is J minus, all right, this is solved by the Pauli matrices. That's the commutation relation of the Pauling matrix. So we can take J minus I to be a Pauling matrix and J plus I to be zero. Suppose we do that and now we solve for J and K. So Ji is just a half J plus J minus. Is that right?
Yeah.
Did that really have come? Yeah. And this is the Pauling matrix, or no, this is zero, this is the Pauling matrix, so we get Pauling matrix over two. For Ki, we see that, how do we get Ki out? Okay, we need to take the difference and multiply by minus I over two. So, we need minus I over 2 times J plus I minus J minus I. See you, Chad.
Do we have a bye?
Oh, okay. all right. This is 0. So we're just going to get I over 2 sigma I. So if we write our general group element, remember our general lambda was e to the minus I theta dot j. I forgot what it was. I had it down here earlier.
Plus I theta dot k.
What do we get? Well, now we know what J and K have to be for this to be lambda less. All right, the transformation of one of these guys is given by taking the exponential minus I over 2 theta dot J, plus sigma. Right? Then here, I over 2 times I is going to be minus a half eta dot sigma. So let's write that as how do we write that? Minus I theta minus eta. Minus I theta minus eta dot sigma over 2. Is the way that our text has it. Okay, so a Lorentz transformation of this restricted form, right, this really only has three complex parameters, well, except there are imaginary parts, but it's in a particular direction. Okay, it's a very particular combination of three generators here. This Lorentz transformation is what will act on the left-handed spinner. To find what happens to the right-handed spinner, we can probably just take the complex conjugate.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for raising your brain.
Is that right? Yeah. No. That's the other one. It's the eta. It's the k-ta switches. Okay, so for... right, this is lambda L. Lambda right, to get this, we k goes to minus k. J is unchanged when you change right to left. So we just get e to the minus I theta plus eta. So that will act on these right-handed things. Higher rank tensors, you just get however many of each kind you need. So if we want to know how to act on a, say, a one-half, so if we have a half in each, this is some object, it's a it's got two of these, two indices. One is right-handed, one is left-handed. We often denote the one by a dot. He mentions this, but he doesn't do it. But that tilde, A dot B dot, or A dot B, is going to be a lambda left, A dot B dot, with a lambda right, BD, no dot, like this, T, C dot, D.
Dot, your first to the left.
Dot, I believe, is left. Yeah, let me see. He does mention this. Let me see if that's in agreement with the... Where did he say that? Yeah. Phi L. Left is with the dot. And you'll see that if you read like Ken Rosenblum's book. Right? They use the dot notation. Walls, I think, where he introduces spinners, uses the dot notation. You'll see this in some of the relativity books, where you have a dot over the left-handed thing. Of course, you'll see a lot of notational dissonance between field theory and relativity. Okay. Just duck and watch him play. Okay, how are we doing? Question. I know I'm moving fast, but we have talked about a lot of this stuff a little bit over the last few weeks. So I'm hoping to be able to. We're doing pretty well, I think. We may get there. Now. There are some operations that we can do on these spinners that relate the left ones and the right ones. Notice, before I press on, we could have something like a 1-0. Suppose we have a 1-0 tensor. That's going to have two dotted indices, and it'll transfer under two left transformations, or a 0-1. Would have two undotted, and that's going to transform as two right. Like this. Okay, so there are... how many degrees of freedom in these things? Let's take the 1/2, 1/2. How many degrees of freedom? I'm guessing four. 2k plus 1 twice, right? So you have 2 in the first slot and 2 in the second. That's 4 degrees of freedom. So that thing is that's a general 2x2 up there. It's complex, and there are some relationships between the complex parts. If we have a 1-0, what do we expect there?
So that 2.
2j plus 1
right.
is going to be 3.
Or,
okay. So these bottom two have 3 degrees of freedom.
So you do it with the 0 as well and get 1 degree of freedom there?
For the scalar. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, so there are going to be 4 as well. So you've got... all right, are we adding or multiplying? No, I think we're multiplying.
Okay.
Yeah, the number of degrees of freedom is two j minus plus 1 times 2 j plus that product.
Okay.
So there are actually more of these than there are of those. The transformation properties, if you take a complex conjugate, it turns left into right and right into left. And these guys, as a result, are capable of being Hermitian. Right? Because it's going to turn that B into a B. When you take the transpose and the conjugate, it's going to give you a B dot A, undotted. And that can look like the same thing. Now, this conjugate is going to turn into one of these, so that will be different. These are the true four vectors. Right? The Hermitian ones are these. Remember, we were able to write a four vector as a 2x2 matrix. Well, those are good. Okay. There are some two little properties here. If I take, well, the Pauli matrices, is it over here?
Let me check. I think.
Okay, so if I take the Pauli matrices and sandwich them between a pair of sigma 2s, and it's a funny thing to do, but this is just a way to write a particular matrix. So I'm taking some particular matrix, happens to be the sigma 2, and multiplying by sigma. All right, well, that's sigma 2. Then this product is the identity times Kronecker I2 plus I epsilon I2 k sigma k. And then sigma 2 times 1 is sigma 2, so I get sigma 2 delta I2 plus I epsilon I2 k. Then sigma 2 times sigma k. What is that? Well, we get an identity times a Kronecker 2k. And then we get another I epsilon, 2k l sigma l. I don't know if this is fancy, but we just forge ahead. So, delta I2 and a sigma 2. Fine. Here, Kronecker 2k changes this to a k, so this becomes epsilon I22. That's zero. Two indices the same, we get zero for the identity piece here. Then we have minus, and now notice there's a sum on k here. I'm going to flip that k to the last position. Or no, let me bring the L to the front. So this is the same as L2K. Right? I move L past two positions, I get two signs.
We just get a Kronecker.
Yeah, this is going to be a Kronecker Li, right? Yeah. The formula is delta I L delta 2 minus delta I2 delta L2. That equals to. And then what? Sigma L. So, what is that? Delta 2, 2 is 1. That's fine. So I have delta I2 sigma 2 minus. All right, what is this thing? Delta IL minus, unless I is 2 and L is 2, sigma L. So, if I equals 2, then I get this sigma 2 here. If I equals 2 here, then L had better equal 2, or I don't get anything there. But if L is 2, these two are 1. So the two terms cancel. So this gives me nothing if I is 2. If I is not 2, then the first term gives me 0. But Then I get a sigma I. I have not two, so this term drops out. So I get sigma I if I is not equal to 2, which means, quite generally, there's a minus sign here. Minus sigma I if it's not equal to 2. How can I write this? Let's see, these two are real. Let me see how I can write this. He writes this as minus sigma I conjugate.
Two tricks. Okay. Sigma 2 is pure imaginary, so the conjugate's negative and cancels the minus sign, so I get sigma 2. Sigma 1 and 3 are real, so the conjugate doesn't do anything, and I get minus. So, a cute way is all this is of writing the conjugate of a polymatrix. So I can write the conjugate of a polymatrix by taking minus and sandwiching it between a pair of polymatrices. So writing a conjugate as a multiplicative transformation. That's all we're doing here. It's a cute trick. Okay, so what this means, though, is that we can... Let me say it. But the conjugation... interchanges the left and right. Okay, so if I've got let chi left be type 1/2 0, right? So it's a left-handed spinner. Then chi f l conjugate is of type 0 1/2. It's going to be right-handed. Okay. Now, if I see how I want to do this, remember lambda L is what, e to the minus I theta, I've got them written right down here, minus eta dot sigma over 2. Lambda R is e to the minus I theta plus eta dot sigma over 2. If I sandwich one of these between some sigma 2s, what's going to happen? So, consider sigma 2 lambda L conjugate sigma 2. All right, what's that going to do? All right, the conjugate changes this to e to the I theta minus eta sigma conjugate over 2, sigma 2. And then the pair of sigma 2s changes that sigma conjugate into minus sigma. So we end up with e to the I theta minus eta. Then we get minus sigma here, so I can write this as minus I theta plus eta dotted into sigma over 2, and that's exactly lambda r. So conjugation together with the sigma 2 transformation is a slick way to turn lambda l into lambda r. We can invert it.
the other way around. If I take lambda r conjugate, that's going to be, alright, sigma 2 conjugate is just minus sigma 2. Then we get lambda l, and we get minus sigma 2. So that's sigma 2, lambda l, sigma 2. And since sigma 2 times sigma 2 is just the identity, multiply both sides by sigma 2, and I see that lambda l is sigma 2, lambda right star, sigma 2, the other way around. So, put all that in mind. Okay. I'm sure these things are going to show up again, so we might as well, you know, look at them. We'll probably spend a lot of time, you know, also looking at properties of Dirac matrices. You need to be able to manipulate spinners to do EQED or weak interactions or such. So now consider the following. Sigma 2 pi L star. So, under a Lorentz transformation, is LT okay for Lorentz transformation? Consider, I want to take. I want to take a left-handed spinner and take sigma 2 times the conjugate. So sigma 2 times pi left conjugate. All right, so the Lorentz transformation of that doesn't do anything to sigma 2. It just gives us a lambda left acting on our phi left conjugate. So the transformation just transforms the original psi L to lambda psi L. So we know how that transforms. But what we can do is write this as sigma 2 lambda L conjugate. And I'm going to stick a pair of sigma 2s in the middle. That's just one. Times psi L conjugate. And now this thing is lambda right. So this is equal to lambda right acting on what? Sigma 2 phi L conjugate. That's where we started. Here. So this object transforms into lambda right, a pure lambda right. So we can say it this way. Sigma 2 phi L star is of type 0 1 half. If phi L is of type 1 half 0. And I'm being a little free with the notation here, okay? All I mean is an element of this is, I mean, it's a spinner of that type. Is my notation clear enough? That was a resounding no.
Should we pause for questions?
Okay, what can we clear up here?
If lambda L is complex, how can you just put it into the parentheses there? Very first thing that you did under self.
So I have a Lorentz transformation. Phi L is going to go to, call it, phi tilde equal lambda L phi L. That's how phi transforms.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm replacing, I have this expression. Lorentz transformations don't do anything to this whole thing in principle. It only acts on that spinner.
Okay.
Other questions? That was good. That felt like it clarified something. Juan, you followed.
I'm fine. I'm just wondering.
Where are you? Which step?
Why are we putting sigma square in the left right here?
Sigma 2.
Sigma 2 and
it's sigma. So it's just a particular matrix I pulled out of the air.
Okay.
I'm saying, consider this object.
Okay.
The matrix sigma 2, you know, I minus I, times the conjugate of a left-handed spinner.
Okay.
So, you know, call it anything you like. You know, call it types of R, because it turns out to be a right-handed spinner.
Okay.
The only point is that that particular combination of, you know, that's a two-component complex thing. We've just proved that it transforms as a right-handed spinner.
Okay.
Yeah, this allows us to construct some further useful stuff, like Dirac spinners. You can build up Dirac spinners as pairs of things. We'll do that in a couple minutes remaining. Maybe we'll see. Let me see what we have to show with this. Okay, he defines charge conjugation. So let's do that. That's sure to come up. So the charge conjugate of a spinner psi. So if of some psi L. So we start with a left-handed spinner. The charge conjugate of that is defined to be essentially that thing, except there's a phase convention. All we're doing here is choosing the phase, and he chooses the phase to be I. That I doesn't actually play any role, okay? It's just an overall phase that turns out to be the convenient thing to do later. This is a right-handed spinner, right? We just proved that. Sigma 2 psi L star transforms as a right-handed spinner. So, you know, the charge conjugate of a left-handed spinner is some kind of right-handed spinner, and vice versa. We can invert this. Let's see, how do we want to invert this? The time R be I sigma 2 phi L star, then I can, if I multiply by I sigma 2 phi R, that's going to be phi L star, so phi L is minus I. So if I take the conjugate of this, I'm going to get plus I, I'm going to get minus sigma 2, and I'm going to get chi r conjugate. So I can turn a right-handed spinner into a left-handed spinner. This is the conjugate, the charge conjugate of a right-handed spinner. That's just inverted, and we pick up a minus sign. All I've done is solve this for psi L in terms of psi R and call that psi L the charge conjugate. So the charge conjugate of a left is a right. Notice that if I take, let's say, psi L conjugate, what's that? That's the charge conjugate of I sigma 2 phi L star. And take that's some right-handed spinner, so I'm going to do this to it. I'm going to multiply by minus I sigma 2. And I'm going to take the conjugate of this thing, which is, all right, I sigma 2 is real, so I just have I sigma 2 times phi L. minus I time minus 1, sigma 2 squared is 1, so I just get back to psi L. So taking the charge conjugate twice brings me back to the same thing. Okay, well, that's that.
And then all you do is a lot more.
For those who like big names. As many do, in fact. Okay, let's see. You're going to have to go, right? You go at 4?
I have to leave by 4:30.
Oh, 4:30. Okay. Okay, so how are you guys doing? 4:30? Can we go to 4:30? Give us that. Okay. Because, we can cover some more stuff by 4:30. I'm not sure if I can quite finish out stuff here, but we might as well push on. Unless your brains are fried. Are your brains fried? Like mush? Yeah. Now, you remember, we're doing field theory Monday to Friday now. Wednesday, for probably 4 weeks, is going to be Octonian. Let me think. What else would happen? I'm going to be gone some. Maybe we should try and meet till 4:30, when we can meet, just to make up for the time I'm going to miss. Let's see, when is it? Not this weekend, the next weekend. Let's see, I think I'm missing like 2 Fridays and a Monday, coming up in a few weeks. So, if it's okay with you to meet a little longer, when we do meet, that'd be good. I won't keep moving this fast. We've spent enough time on chapter 2, and I want to get through and clean it up and finish talking about it. The next chapter is classical field theory, and that'll get a little more comfortable. Some stuff, another theorem and stuff like that. We've been through that before. We'll review that. Okay, let's see. Charge conjugation. He talks about... he talks about these one-half representations a little bit. I think we've been counting the complex dimension. Let's see, if we take two... Let me repeat what he says here about the one-half state. Just in case it comes up again. So, talking about the one-half state. If we have a chi left and a phi right. Is that where he starts? No, exactly that.
Right.
So let's take an arbitrary left-handed spinner and an arbitrary right-handed spinner. And what he wants to do is actually find the four vector. Or the four vectors that you can get out of these guys. Okay, so the claim is if we let sigma mu be 1 and Pauli matrices, and sigma mu bar the 1 and minus the Pauli matrices,
Then we can take psi L dagger to U chi right. That particular linear combination of Hold on. Too much to right there. Oh. I had it right the first time. We can build a left-handed spinner corresponding to psi r by charge conjugation. So minus I turning to conjugate on the right. And we can build a right-handed version of psi l by taking I sigma 2 by L star. So from each of these, we can build some corresponding left and right. Right ones, he builds this. The two left ones, he uses the sigma bar, and the two left ones. And, you know, let's call this U, and V. And I think he leads to the problem to show that those things actually transform as Lorentz spore vectors. So, you know how those various psi transform. So you can figure out how these transform. And it turns out that these transform as vectors. So you could write out explicit components here, various ways to try and prove this. Use the lambda r as we derive to show that this transforms as a four vector. But essentially, you know, between two of these, you've got four complex numbers. And so you should be able to construct, you know, two real four vectors actually. So you have enough degrees of freedom to get to, and I'm fairly confident that you've got a correct way of doing that here that will give us two well-defined Lorentz four vectors. Okay, then so 1, 0 and 0, 1. We said those had three degrees of freedom each. 2j plus 1 is 3 for these. What they are these are parts of an antisymmetric tensor. All like the Maxwell field tensor, right? If we've got a tensor that's totally anti-symmetric, equal to its anti-symmetric part, then we know that has 6 degrees of freedom. These are the self-dual and the anti-self-dual parts of that. The only catch is that those don't exist in the space-time. They only exist under SL4. This is of interest for the research, and there's a relevant problem here that you guys who want to look at spinners in biconformal space, and particularly if you want to quantize and think about Ashtakar's anti-self dual way of writing the spin connection. All right, problem 2.5. Okay, so yeah, the last problem 2.6 is interesting too. Problem 2.5. Let me say a little bit about what's going on here. So let's see DC becomes black. A until of the I epsilon mu nu alpha beta A alpha beta. So you know that's the dual of A. And the question is, can we have A tilde mu nu equal to plus or minus A mu nu? In which case we say it's self-dual or anti-self-dual. And it doesn't quite work in space-time because of the sign difference between epsilon up and epsilon down. That mucks it up. So let's see. I have to think whether there's an easy way to prove this. You know, it works if you complexify. You can make it work if you complexify, and you may have to stick a conjugate in as well as taking the dual. So you define the dual as this construction times a conjugate, and then you can find a self-dual or anti-self-dual part. Let me think what's going on here. You know, this is the relationship between the electric and magnetic parts of the Maxwell field tensor. Okay, you can see if in the epsilon expression there, if alpha and beta are say 1, 2, there are a couple spatial instances, then mu nu have to be like a 0, 3. So you get so if you start with a magnetic field D, you're going to get an electric field. So this expresses like a duality between electric and magnetic fields. And the thing that happens is under a duality, just if you put epsilon mu nu alpha beta on the Maxwell field tensor F mu nu, it B goes to E, but E goes to minus B. There's a funny minus sign.
It's kind of like a hot stool.
Yeah, it is hot.
Oh,
okay. These are the components of the
logic.
Okay. So you could make it all covariant and write it with one. It probably makes more sense that way. But, with something like the spin connection, right, the spin connection is one form, but it's got an anti-symmetric pair. So you can put an epsilon on that anti-symmetric pair and come up with a dual in the tensor space, not in the form space. I mean, it's the same thing. It's just working in a different space. So, yes, it is a Hodge dual, but you're not necessarily working with forms.
Oh, excuse me.
Whose phone is that? Did you lose your phone?
Yeah, mine. It's
oh,
just
okay. Okay. Oh, we're not expecting a call. let's see. Yeah, this self-dual or anti-self-dual. I think when Ashikar was trying to come up with improved variables for quantizing gravity. He took the spin connection and complexified it so that you could take a self-dual or an anti-self-dual part, and looked at the anti-self-dual part of the complexified spin connection. Or you take it to the imaginary or something. Well, you know, this probably all works very well in Euclidean space. Right? So it seems to me that if we look at anti-self-dual spin connections in the Euclidean space, that the canonical quantization procedure might be smoother. Pure conjecture, but that could work. Because, you know, he has to complexify to write it in space-time. Because, remember, epsilon with four indices down and epsilon with four indices up differ by a sign. You know, that sign mucks things up when you try to make something self-dual or anti-self-dual.
Raising with the
Minkowski
metric, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but in Euclidean, we're raising with a Euclidean metric.
Right, so it's the same.
Yeah, it's just the same tensor. So we won't have that. And you can have flat out self dual and anti self dual tensor. So this is worth taking a look at. Anyway, it turns out that the 1-0 and the 0-1 representations are parts of an anti-symmetric tensor. They're self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of some anti-symmetric tensor. Okay. So, changing gears. 2.6 is about field representation. This is, I guess this is the fourth representation for the groups of interest. We talked about the adjunct, we talked about the fundamental, we talked about the covering group. One more representation. We want field representation. And field representations are ones which treat, say, a space-time field. Take a scalar field. It's a function on all space-time. Right? They form a vector space. You can add functions, take linear combinations, that sort of thing. So a function space is the linear vector space, and we can find linear, usually differential operators on the space of functions that give you new functions. So we can represent the effects of the Lorentz or in fact Poincaré groups as some kinds of operators on a function space. Well, that function space is our space of fields. We're going to want to know how Lorentz transformations act on fields, not just some fixed spinner, okay? Phi L can just be some two-component alpha beta, you know, pair of complex numbers. But what we really want is each of those components to be a function of space and time. So we want the components of these spinners to be, you know, functions of functions. So since the Lorentz transformation can change the space-time coordinates, you get two things. Okay, so we want field representation there. We have some function of space-time position. Well, if it's a scalar function, then, you know, this is just going to go to, you know, some, well, in general, it goes to some phi prime at some x time. But x prime is just a new label for the points, and phi prime is the scalar. This is actually the same object. This is actually equal to phi of x. We don't see any effects because we're just changing the names of things. This is true for a scalar field. If we had a spinner, a spinner field, say chi alpha of x, too many x, chi alpha of x. Think of x as a four-vector position in space-time. What's going to happen? Well, you know, we're going to suppose it's a left-handed spinner. Then there's going to be some left-handed alpha beta psi beta of x prime. So the labels for the point change and the components of the spinner mix in the usual way. We get both kinds of transformation happening. And for higher rank tensors, there's a corresponding picture. So what we need to do is go through and look at how objects change. Let me see. Etc. When they're fueled. Let x prime be x plus some small change in x. All right, we can then expand these fields in the Taylor series. The thing we want to look at is sort of mixed. What we want to do is look at how the fields change when we transform the field but not the point. Okay, so if I transform a field and, you know, let it be at the new position, I just get the transformations we've seen already. But if I do a Lorentz transformation but hold x fixed, instead of changing this, look at something like phi prime of x minus phi of the same point x, not the transformed point. We're going to call this del zero of phi. It's not transforming everything at once, but this will show us the effect of. This will let us find incompatible generators for these things. Bearing in mind that phi prime of x prime is the same as the original phi of x for scalars, this will actually give us something interesting. So let's see what it gets. So del zero of phi, it says phi prime of x minus phi of x. But phi, since we know what del x is, del x plus x is x prime. So we can write x as x prime minus del x. So solve it the other way around and substitute here. We have del zero of phi is phi prime of x prime minus del x minus phi of x. Okay, now scan this in the Taylor series, and you see what I'm trying to get to is phi prime of x prime, so it'll cancel. So let's expand this in the Taylor series is around x prime. Then I get minus d phi prime dx times del x. This is evaluated at x prime. Minus phi of x.
Only first two. Oh.
And these two go away. So this variation actually gives me, let me write this on this slide so I can separate out the dx here. Okay. Acting on phi prime. Now, what am I
well, in four dimensions, del naught of phi. These are derivatives in all directions. Del x, right, this is del x alpha plus x alpha is x alpha prime. So this is going to be minus del x alpha dx alpha. Okay. Starting to see the generator, but now how do we... Okay. We know what this thing is. Right. Remember, del x comes from a Lorentz transformation. Delta alpha beta plus an infinitesimal epsilon alpha beta acting on x beta minus our original x alpha. So it's a generator. It's an infinitesimal generator acting on x. But we know what the infinitesimal generators look like. Right? We have generators J mu nu, and we can write each generator. So this tells us what plane and space-time we're rotating in. We've got some rho sigma as the components of, so say a boost in the x direction would be J 0 1, and that's some particular matrix. So a transformation here is just some linear combination of those. So I can write del x alpha as some linear combination of the J mu nu, where each J mu nu is a matrix that then acts on x. So this is actually what that del x is. Under an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, we just get some linear combination of the generators. You remember the half is there because we define these to be anti-symmetric, so we're double counting here. Each of W and J is defined to be, the labels are defined to be anti-symmetric. So, what we have is del naught of phi is equal to minus 1 half W mu nu, J mu nu, alpha, beta, x, beta, dx, alpha, acting on phi. And since J is anti-symmetric, you notice what's going to happen here is that x beta and the dx alpha is going to anti-symmetrize. So we've got something that looks like an angular momentum generator. That's exactly what it is. X cross beta. Right. Let me write this as we have a form for these generators. J mu nu alpha beta be, we make the transformation, but basically we want mu equal to alpha and mu equal to beta, or the other way around, mu equal to beta and mu equal to alpha. So we have something like that for the generators, the 4x4 matrix generators, just anti-symmetric, where mu is equal to beta and mu alpha, or vice versa. Let me see if I've got the same sign convention. Mu alpha, yeah.
Okay, so substitute. And we have minus 1/2. Our parameters, we have an I here to make information. Then we have eta, mu, alpha, delta, nu, beta, minus eta, let's see, what should we have here? Which one's eta? Mu, alpha, delta, mu, beta, times x beta, dv, x, alpha, phi. Okay, so x beta becomes a nu, then this is a partial with respect to x alpha, raises to become a partial x mu. Then we have minus, that becomes x nu, partial x nu. This is phi prime at x prime. That's the same as phi of x. I can drop the prime here. Let me drop the prime. That's phi prime at x prime. Sorry.
Okay.
So we see the angular momentum operator emerging here. So we call this thing. So take the minus I here. So we have x nu d nu minus x nu. And that's orbital angular momentum. Orbital. Now, when we do the same thing for a spinner field next time, we'll see that we still get this, but we also get the spinner rotation. So we get intrinsic spin and we get orbital angular momentum, the sum of an L and a J for each of those as the total angular momentum operator. So next time, let's see, next on Friday, we can go through that. We are closing in very fast on the end of this chapter. We'll certainly finish that up Friday, and I'll start talking about classical fields. That was all fast and furious. How do you feel? You got it? I hope, even though some of that was a blip, that it was also this overview that it ties together some sort of random pieces that we've stumbled through over the last couple of weeks. Ties it together. How's your reading going? You read chapter 2?
Yeah. This might help in getting through chapter 2.
Yeah. So read chapter 2 and then some questions.